This is hell.
Neoliberalism is causing an epidemic of anxiety. It seeps into every part of our lives, forcing us to constantly pit us against each other, seeing everybody as a source of competition and doing everything it can to kill cooperation, leaving us alone to fend for ourselves. Yes, it is that bad, but there still may be a way out. Here to tell us all we need to know about neoliberalism and what we still may be able to do about it, Julie A. Wilson is author of Neoliberalism, which is part of the Key Ideas in Media and Cultural Studies series being published by Routledge. Other titles and topics in the series include cultural policy, reality TV, culture, and representation. Welcome to This Is Hell, Julie.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on the show. This is a fascinating, fascinating book. It's a really great, concise, and very direct explanation of neoliberalism, its effects, and what we still may be able to do about it. And we want to thank listener Jessica for suggesting Julie as a guest, and everybody who has heard their suggested guests on our show. Please show your support at www.wnur.org/donate. Julie, you write, within academia, neoliberalism is a controversial term. Scholars continue to debate its usefulness. On one hand, for some, neoliberalism is a buzzword, a catchphrase. It is a term that is so often repeated and invoked that it has lost its meaning. According to these critiques, neoliberalism is presented as a scary monster that is everywhere and nowhere all at once. It has come to figure as shorthand for everything that is evil in our world. And as a result, it ends up teaching us very little about what specifically is wrong, how exactly we got there, and what actually can be done to change course. On the other hand, as you point out, other scholars prefer not to use the term because they argue that it is misleading for them. Neoliberalism is simply an advanced form of liberal capitalism. There's nothing really new or neo here. So why overstate and confuse things with a prefix? Is neoliberalism an appropriate word to use? Isn't neoliberalism simply capitalism or privatization and nothing more or less? What makes that a useful term for you?
Well, so for me, as a professor of media and cultural studies and working with young people, I think neoliberalism is important to kind of hang on to, perhaps because, as I talk about in the introduction that you just read from, it gives us a way to kind of map our conjuncture or the kind of complicated interplay of social, political, economic forces that kind of shape and make the world as it is. I think we all know we live in a kind of global, complex society. It's cliche. And I think what young people are really wrestling with is that they know everything's really messed up, and that there's so much information and so many different kind of explanations out there. But how do you put it all together and kind of tell a coherent story that not just explains things, but that helps them form the kind of intellectual and emotional or affective capacities they need to build a new world. And so in that sense, I'm a fan of talking about neoliberalism from a kind of critical perspective with young people. I have to say, though, when I wrote my dissertation back when I was in graduate school, I don't even think I used the word, even though I could have easily, because I just felt like, wow, everyone talks about neoliberalism. It wasn't until the context of teaching that I really started to think about what it could do for our kind of imaginations, I guess, radical imaginations.
Is that because younger people have lived through neoliberalism their entire life, so it's a more of a touchstone, and maybe they even understand neoliberalism better than older generations?
I think as a cultural studies scholar, what we're really interested in is helping students think about their everyday lives and why they feel the way that they do. What are the larger forces that are shaping those? And so, as a critical person who believes in and kind of got inspired to go into education by critical pedagogy, who was always really committed to meeting students where they're at, neoliberalism, like you're saying, really does help to name, define what they're kind of feeling and what they already know, right? And it helps them, again, put a story to it in ways that perhaps, other, folks that have, lived, through the civil rights movement or other kind of historical moments might not find it as useful. But I think for young people that, you know, my students right now, you know, barely remember 9/11 at this point, right? And they're kind of what they grew up in was post-2008, like the first years coming into my classes. So I think it's helpful to help them get their head around their conjuncture and that the moment that they're in.
So what happens
and
when
the challenges they're facing? Yeah.
So what happens when we are all in competition with each other and everything, including ourselves? How does that change the way we view ourselves, our neighbors, our family, and our friends and our world?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think what was interesting about writing this book and the research I did, which I have to say was totally undertaken with my students. So they were kind of guiding me and helping me figure out, you know, what was it that they were really wanting to learn and were helping to see. And I think that before I hadn't really understood that, like, competition, we're not just talking about market competition, but this, like, what you're getting at, this sense of competition in everyday life that kind of really structures at a deep way how we're oriented to the world, to other people, and also to what are the kind of broader political stories that we tell and see our role in them. So I think what happens for young people is that they feel, even though they might know at a certain level, like, I want to have these deep relationships. I know that the world is messed up and I want to, you know, change it. They still feel incredibly disciplined by the ways in which they have to be kind of competing human capital, and they have to take personal responsibility for their futures. And they a lot of them are taking on significant amounts of debt. So that in and of itself is disciplining too, right? And I think that then this has all kinds of consequences for their everyday lives. They find it incredibly hard to trust other people to work together. They feel, even if they don't want it, they feel like they constantly, and I know you mentioned it earlier in the show, have to be a kind of brand and be working on this brand. And they feel incredibly like they're failing all the time because, you know, if it's, you know, your whole life is built around an impossibility, which personal responsibility and this idea that we can self-appreciate our way to success is impossible, then of course failure is always imminent. It's not just there. I think for me, though, too, that probably the biggest impetus to write the book was to what that kind of sense of competition and disconnection from other people and lack of a kind of trust and a kind of what I talk about in the book is this willingness to kind of take a risk that something else might be possible is how it seeps into our political imaginations as well. So that there's so many ways that competition has become this kind of deep structure of our politics and that it feels like sometimes there's no way to get out of what, you know, that kind of sense that there is really, like Margaret Thatcher says, no alternative to capitalism and to kind of meritocracy and to market-based solutions.
And you write how neoliberalism has profoundly transformed the fabric of identity and social life. How does neoliberalism reinvent the belief in individual liberties, property rights, free markets? How does neoliberalism change the liberalism that the U.S. was founded upon?
Yeah, I think that that's really good and I think a really interesting and rich question, because I do think that one of the things that fascinated me in the writing of the book and kind of delving deeper into neoliberalism was that shift in the very ideologies of individualism. So within liberalism, the idea, or like, you know, earlier forms of liberalism, the idea of the individual was rooted in property and, you know, the kind of abstract individual rights that are prescribed in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, all those kinds of things that were founded the state and capitalism and kind of undergird that. Within neoliberalism, though, the state's role really shifts from thinking of itself as a kind of territory, with a population that it is taking care of, to a kind of promoter of global competition, where the state isn't really interested in taking care of the population and maximizing the wealth of individuals and nurturing rights. And then as a result of, you know, all these things are connected, but that the kind of theory of individualism within neoliberalism is really not about kind of abstract rights or even having property. It's about that you are this human capital that has to compete and must constantly be self-appreciating. So the self is capital that must be appreciated. And I think that is a pretty profound shift in political philosophy and our kind of theories about what it means to be the individual. And obviously that comes from neoliberal philosophers like Hayek and whatnot.
I remember talking to a friend who is a diehard supporter of the Democratic Party about why I was not supporting Al Gore for president back in 2000, when I told my friend I wasn't voting for Al Gore, as Gore was part of the neoliberal Democratic Leadership Council wing of the Democratic Party, a wing we have been critical of dating back to the beginning of this show in 1997, I guess. 1996, actually. My friend asked what neoliberalism was. When I told him, he said, "That's not liberalism, as in the Democratic Party's version of it from the New Deal through the Great Society. In fact, the DLC stopped operating in 2011 as there was no need for it anymore, as neoliberalism had become a core belief of nearly all Democrats and within the party." How much has neoliberalism changed not only the Democratic Party, but how much does neoliberalism distinguish the divide between the Hillary Clinton wing of the Democratic Party and the Bernie Sanders wing of the party?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's important to remember that, like, you know, our political horizons and kind of hegemonic consensus or whatever is always shifting a little bit. But for the most part, I would say that the Democratic Party has been entirely kind of complicit in the rise and the kind of cementing of neoliberalism as the kind of hegemonic, as the new hegemony, I guess. But, what Bernie Sanders did, I think, was really tap into, I think, you know, young people and everyone that knows that the Democratic Party hasn't really been successful and meeting the needs of the vast majority of working people. He tapped into something, but at this point, it was really depressing to watch the Democratic Party, really cynically marshal identity politics. I'm talking about Hillary Clinton, to undermine a kind of more socialist agenda. And I still feel like that is going on at the level of the kind of national Democratic Party. I think what's happening on the ground, however, in local communities, I live in what a lot of, you might call part of Trump country. It's a post-industrial small community in northwestern Pennsylvania. But like on the ground, there is all kinds of different organizing happening. And so I take your question. I think at the level of national politics, like the Democratic Party's embrace of neoliberalism, I think is still pretty strong. And we saw that in what happened to the Sanders campaign and the kind of infighting that continues to happen and the kind of pushing out of that wing, even as it still exerts pressure. But on the ground, I think it's a little bit more complicated, and that there's all kinds of organizing happening, and in certain places it might not be happening under the label of the Democratic Party, just because of the population or the way that state elections work and local elections and whatnot.
Do you think Hillary lost because she was still trying to defend, was still supporting neoliberalism? Do you think the reason Hillary Clinton lost the election was due to a lack of her campaign's recognition that the country, that neoliberalism, is in crisis?
Yeah, I talk about that in the conclusion to the book. So I was writing, I wrote this, you might be able to tell, but I wrote it pretty quickly with students over the course of several months. And we were watching what was happening with the Trump campaign, with the Sanders and with Clinton. And my sense was that this was a kind of crisis moment that the kind of cracks in neoliberalism are incredibly profound, and they have been growing since 2008, and again for lots of people for way longer than that, whether it was a Republican or a Democrat, a kind of centrist neoliberal candidate probably wasn't going to marshal the kind of energy and imagination that requires to move the needle in our ridiculous system. And so my sense is that, and that maybe I'm an optimist, that, Sanders, could have won, that I think Clinton was not a crisis candidate. It was too representative of the status quo that's not working for the vast majority of people. And it's unclear. I mean, Trump's all over the place. I think people maybe were hoping that some people that voted for Trump were hoping for something other than neoliberalism, which is obviously not what they're getting. But I do think that it was a kind of moment, in history where, as the Democrats should have run someone who was not a neoliberal.
So what impact do you think the sense of perpetual competition that neoliberalism has, what impact do you think that can have on the family? Do you think there's any contradiction among those who support neoliberalism and life constantly being about being in competition with others and what people may define as family values? Is neoliberalism in competition with family values? Because often I find people on the far right who are seem to be for at least the ideas of neoliberalism and people just being on their own and individual and belief in the self-made myth, that they also believe in family values. And those two things seem to contradict each other to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really insightful question. I spent a lot of time talking in another book to women with young children about their everyday lives and kind of with the digital culture and all the work that they do to try to keep family together, right? I think that what happens is that neoliberalism, we don't talk about it very much, but neoliberalism advances on the backs of women's labor. So if you're going to roll back public support for schools and for all kinds of the kind of social infrastructures that we need to kind of carry on life, it really relies on the family to pick up the slack. And because of the gender division of labor that we have and the way that caring work is still naturalized to women and exploited in various ways, that it is, women that end up kind of stepping in and providing the glue to hold society together. So neoliberalism is profoundly contradictory, especially for women in a lot of ways, because on the one hand, it says, oh, women, we're in this post-feminist era, women can be a brand and can do whatever they want. And neoliberalism kind of welcomes this, diverse, post-feminist world where, women can do anything and you can choose to have a family or not. But on the other hand, it continues to kind of rely on their labor. So it's, I think that it does both. On the one hand, if you're a social conservative, that you're speaking about family values, like in so many ways, that is compatible with neoliberalism and a kind of, well, what I talk about in the book in a more right neoliberal kind of milieu and kind of sensibility that is very much based on a more conservative or traditional social hierarchies of gender and race and nationality and whatnot versus a left neoliberalism, which still exploits women's labor and relies on it, but speaks in much more, I guess, empowering, marketized kind of equality rhetoric. if you will.
We are speaking with
Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. We are speaking with Julie A. Wilson. She is author of Neoliberalism. And the earlier book that Julie was just mentioning that she has written was co-authored with Emily Chivers-Yoakum. And the title of that book is Mothering Through Precarity, Women's Work and Digital Media. And that came out 1 year ago this month. If competition leads to innovation, how does neoliberalism's embrace of competition undermine our political imagination? Can competition lead to technological innovation while killing social and political imagination?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think it's a question of, you know, I always back up for a second. My students always, when we start on this journey, they'll say things like, well, isn't competition good or isn't innovation good? You know, and, you know, my argument about neoliberalism is that you can't make competition and personal responsibility and all these things a basis for kind of society, that there are just too many things that we need to do together in order for the kind of common good, right? And so I think that neoliberalism, the kind of false promises, if you will, of innovation and competition and like we're going to have this Hayek talks about the market is the site of truth and the spontaneous order and solutions that to people's needs will genuinely be worked out in the market is a kind of huge myth. But it's what allows us and kind of is the rationale for kind of hollowing out public institutions, democratic institutions, as well as our own capacities for participating in those and our own desires to be a part of those. And so, you know, I think that what I want my students to do is I guess, to innovate at the level of political imagination. But in order to do that, they're going to have to get outside of a kind of market paradigm, which is what I think what neoliberalism and what competition have done is kind of create this sense that the only way to move forward is through the market. When markets might very well have a role to play in a kind of much more egalitarian and just society that works for all. But, you know, put it crudely, when a society is organized around profits versus people, that's when you run into misery, social misery, inequality, and all the things that neoliberalism gives us.
And you write, neoliberalism incites us to live as self-enclosed individuals, as competition necessarily pits us against our peers and the rest of the world. Is it possible to effectively fight climate change, when we talk about the world around us, is it possible to effectively fight climate change while still embracing neoliberalism?
I don't think so. You know, climate change is one of those what's at stake is the planet and everything living on it, and it requires a kind of global cooperation. As Naomi Klein has said, you know, solving climate change, addressing it, is not compatible with continued neoliberal capitalism. And so, you know, if we can, you know, I think what neoliberalism tells us is as self-enclosed individuals who are looking to self-appreciate within the market, we might have a role to play in combating climate change by, say, buying green products, right? Or expressing our views on social media about how wrong climate change is. But that's ultimately not going to do much to actually do something about the problem. It's a market-based kind of response, I guess you could say, that we can buy better products, that we can express outrage that gets quantified and used to sell us better messages on social media. But it's not a practice of collective governing. And to fight climate change, we need a kind of global process of cooperation and governance that seems increasingly impossible to even imagine what that could look like.
Which is at odds with the New York Times reporting this week about young Republicans and how they are looking to actually come up with a policy for fighting climate change. But of course, all of those policies are involved with market solutions. You write, "We move through the world with an oppositional consciousness where all things are potential threats to our own individual self." How much does neoliberalism lead to fear? Because here in the States, violent crime has been in precipitous decline, yet the media portrays the nation constantly in fear. So to what degree does neoliberalism and competition cause fear, even paranoia, and fear that's completely unnecessary?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's maybe even more so than fear, which I think is a definite byproduct of this. I think it's a level of everyday life and just kind of moving through the world. It's more about this sensibility of kind of threat that at any moment things can fall apart. And so, or something can, you know, it can be, you know, it could be violent crime, you know, that the media reports on it and whatnot, but could also be something as small as, you know, a car breaking down or something like that. But we just move through the world that any person or anything happening could undo everything that you're kind of trying desperately to hold on to, right? And so everything's to be held suspect, to be evaluated and in terms of risk or threat. And I think that that's a really, like you said, it's paranoid, but it's also like completely debilitating, right, in terms of social life. If we're all just kind of moving through, looking at every interaction or every potential invitation or kind of social scenario in terms of that framework of risk management, of potential harm, it makes it really difficult to think about things like organizing politically with other people, to trust other people. And so when I think about an oppositional consciousness, and I want to make clear by that, I mean, I'm drawing from a feminist scholar named Anna Louise Keating there. It's not so much that opposition and political antagonism is the problem, because, right, we know that, like, if we're going to build a communist, a better world that's, like, you know, beyond capitalism, we're going to need to fight like hell for it. But I do think it's to say that we need to move out of this paradigm of constant fear, threat, and mistrusting of other people to a world-building one where we remember that there are alternatives, that people are social constructions and historical, and that, you know, the world isn't always going to be this way, and it's a question of how we're going to show up and what part we're going to play in organizing for a better future. So, but I think that oppositional consciousness is a real stumbling block at a very minute, like, kind of everyday life level that prevents us from kind of being and desiring to be in common with other people.
So how much do you think, because you mentioned, let me read this quote real quick, neoliberalism and its diffusion of competition throughout society make the infrastructures that undergird our lives profoundly unstable while simultaneously diminishing our senses of interdependence and social connections. Now, I understand that you're using infrastructure in a, you know, not just a physical term, but also a psychological term. But how much does neoliberalism lead to the crumbling infrastructure that we have, lead to our roads and our schools becoming worse?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that that is a huge, I mean, neoliberalism is to blame for that. I live in a place where you can see that all the time and every day, divestment and the gutting of local government. And it's a huge way to organize common ground around, right? And it's and I also see folks out in where I live also organizing actively for what you talk about as those psychological infrastructures as well. So people are working on the ground to make housing safer. I mean, we have a huge rental population here, but they're all in, and so they're fighting for that, those kind of physical infrastructures, figuring out how to partner in particular ways to take care of basic material, things like roads and bridges. But they're also organizing to, you know, bring people together across divides whether we're talking about race or socioeconomics or whatnot, cultural, religion, and to kind of experiment with what we could do when we just kind of come together and do things that are free and fun. And that's a different kind of an infrastructure. Again, that's working on people's capacities to be together and to want to be together and to not just go through, you know, walk down the street and see someone and think that they're a threat, right? But like, no, we can be in this place together to do things collectively.
How much do you feel those who dismiss neoliberalism as a term or deny it as a concept are also in denial of any common ground we may all occupy and share?
And I think I could go different directions on that. I do think that I get tired of academic debates at this point. So when I was writing this book, I was thinking, like, I'm just going to be polyamorous, right? If someone helps us understand neoliberalism a lot better, whether they like the term or not, right, I still am going to just use them and put it all together in a particular way. I do think when people use neoliberalism or use the idea of political economic critique, saying that that is somehow incompatible with identity-based movements or something like we see in kind of politics these days, like with the Clinton campaign, I think that that's profoundly destructive. I'm more sympathetic to the people that want to disparage neoliberalism, saying that we need to fight for communism or socialism and like stop trying to complicate it. Capitalism is the problem, not neoliberalism. Let's just call it by name. I'm more sympathetic to those critiques, but I also think that there's something that we talked about earlier in the interview. There is something new about neoliberalism. And I think that the things that are new about it, what's happened to the state and to privatization of public goods, like that was not classical liberalism. It wasn't even laissez-faire capitalism, right? So these are pretty profound shifts and how we're supposed to think about ourselves as people and what governance is supposed to be. Neoliberalism is ademocratic and absolutely hostile to democracy and collective governance of all forms, except those through the market. And so I think that to the people that are saying, just call it capitalism, I'm sympathetic. But if we are going to do that, then let's just be clear that we're talking about the world that people actually inhabit, right? Which I think is a neoliberal one.
You write that when asked to consider various forms of privilege, many of my white male students get defensive. The idea that they haven't earned their place through their own decisions and hard work, but rather benefited from inherited wealth and opportunity, means that they are not good people from the perspective of neoliberalism. To what degree, then, do those who dismiss neoliberalism as a term dismiss it because they have, to some degree, benefited from privilege?
So I think what's interesting about that is that my experience with students is that they don't dismiss neoliberalism when they understand what it means. So those same white male students who get defensive and have trouble speaking about privilege, they're much more able to think through that and to talk about it when there's a kind of common ground. And I think that's what teaching about neoliberalism can do, because when you put these, issues of inequality and exploitation and kind of historical legacies of settler colonialism that we're still living with very much, when you take it out of an interpersonal frame, which is what the dominant discourses of, I think, privilege and inclusion discourse and diversity, which are governing discourses of neoliberalism, when you take it out of that and give everyone a kind of common ground, it doesn't mean you're all the same. But when you take it out of that, then, you know, students are much more eager and willing and capable of engaging. And I teach a lot of, because of the way our curriculum is set up, I end up teaching and working with a lot of economic students who are by far the most conservative students on campus. And it's amazing how much they are. I used to be kind of scared, but they engage. And I think that that was one of the reasons I wrote the book, because I thought, wow, talking about this thing can really allow us to have these conversations where it gets away from that kind of competition self-enclosed individualism in which certain people clearly have way more privilege and not, you know, a lot to lose, to this place where the students are working together across those differences and are okay with those differences and willing to acknowledge histories and their own positions because they're seeing it within this larger frame, I guess, that they all feel that they can, that they all understand and share, I guess.
How far do you think recognizing that everyone suffers from the same anxiety brought on by neoliberalism would go toward challenging the system that makes us anxious? How far do we, I mean, how much do we have to just realize? We had Jennifer Baumgartner on the show maybe 14 years ago, and she was talking about how we have to constantly remind people how feminism or how labor organizing brought about the things that we have in our life, the benefits that we have in our life to raise feminism and union organizing to a higher level of understanding and a greater degree of embracement. So how far would recognizing that everyone suffers from the same anxiety go toward challenging the system that makes us anxious?
I think that it could. I think it's, again, it's one of those kind of shared common experiences that has the potential to bring people into relation with one another and to create a kind of shared sense of what's wrong and what kind of world we would want to live in. Again, though, the tricky part comes from that can't erase all the very real differences in histories at the same time, right? And that's a tricky thing. But I do think that that anxiety and the kind of, you know, depression and also just the how unhealthy we are, right? And how bad everyone feels, whether they, you know, they have a diagnosis for it or not. I do think that is a potentially very fertile ground for organizing and for seeing connections and for thinking about and having young people think about, well, what would a world, if my anxiety is not my fault or not coming from me and it's coming from the social world, why is that? And what would a world that was designed to produce a different kind of, you know, feeling of being in it look like? And I have found that to be a very productive conversation to have with young people, for sure.
So how much
it kind of, you know, gets their imagination going.
Right, right. And how much is the first step toward challenging neoliberalism the realization that its power over our lives is tenuous? And if it's so tenuous, as you write it is, so weak, so insubstantial, then why haven't we unclenched the grip it has on our lives?
I think there are a lot of reasons for that, because as tenuous it is, it's also, and what I'm trying to say is that it's everywhere and we hate it, but it's at the same time, it's because it's everywhere and we hate it that it is tenuous almost. And so I think that there's a lot of evidence to suggest actually that that neoliberalism is, I hope, on its last legs. Like I said, I think young people are ready for socialism. They were ready for Bernie Sanders. They're open. They're starting to organize more and more. Then there's also, again, what's happening on the ground in communities and has been for decades in places where people are building new economic systems, cooperative worker co-ops. And so, I mean, it's going to be a process. In terms of preventing that, I do think that one of the hardest and thorniest and I don't even know what to do about it issues is the increasing mediation of everyday life and the rise of social networks and the power of algorithms and big data to kind of shape the environment that we work in. I think that new communication tools can be great for organizing, and they certainly are, but at the same time, you know, they also really reinforce neoliberalism and self-enclosed individualism and competition and branding and all those logics too. And I think I don't know how to. I'm a media scholar and I study it, so I don't. I don't like it when people say, "Oh, just get off media, stop watching TV, and whatnot. Everything will be okay." But I do think that that is one of the biggest challenges because it's so embedded in our everyday lives. And it's those digital and media infrastructures are, you know, they're neoliberal machines, I guess, for the most part.
Where do you see what you call the fissures and fault lines where resistance and transformation of neoliberalism are in fact possible? Because you also write that there is no pure outside to get to or work from. That's just the nature of the neoliberalism's totalizing cultural power. But let's not forget that neoliberalism's totalizing cultural power is also a source of weakness. So how is neoliberalism's totalizing cultural power also a source of its weakness? And where do you see these fissures and fault lines that we can challenge neoliberalism?
So, for example, I mean, if you privatize everything, right, and you get rid of and like destroy the kind of infrastructures that make people's lives difficult or make people's lives possible, if you take that away, people are going to have to, out of necessity, right, hopefully come together and figure things out. And so it seems to me that neoliberalism is kind of constantly sowing the seeds of its own demise by the fact that it doesn't take care of the basic infrastructures, whether those are psychological, like our health, right, and our mental health, or whether it's, you know, our communities and the kind of basic things like that we need to live. I think that that's where the fissures and fault lines are, and that people, you know, that I talk about in the book, this idea of disaffected consent, like people acquiesce to neoliberalism, but they're completely disaffected from it, right? They don't like it. They're kind of disciplined into it by debt and by kind of the norm of competition and the kind of social Darwinism that it promotes. But at the same time, that is that's a pretty tenuous, like that disaffected consent is a pretty tenuous thing to build a society on. And so the possibility for organizing is tremendous. And I think that because we've never had in a lot of ways more in common than we do right now, you know, being able to let go of this self-enclosed individualism could unleash a kind of broad kind of socialist project. I mean, and again, I think we're already seeing that with the rise of worker cooperatives. I mean, what's going on in Jackson, Mississippi right now with Cooperation Jackson is amazing. And that's just one community. And we see it all over the Rust Belt in places that, you know, they're not the media capital, so they're not getting talked about. But on the ground, people are exploiting those fault lines within neoliberalism. And right now, I don't think it's we've got the kind of new story figured out, and it doesn't have a name yet. But I think that's where we're heading.
Right, and you talk about that, the status quo stories and news stories. And so just so people know that we have just skimmed the surface of Julie's book. Julie A. Wilson is author of Neoliberalism. She's an associate professor at Allegheny College in the Department of Communications, Arts, and Theater. And as we were saying earlier, she's co-author of a book that came out last year with Emily Shivers-Yocum called Mothering Through Precarity, Women's Work and Digital Media. One last question for you, Julie, and as we do with all of our guests, it's the question from hell, the question we hate to ask, you might hate to answer, or our audience is going to hate your response. What you hope to see is that everybody sees that they have a life in common, that we share common lives. But to what degree is there a common good? Isn't what I think is good for me not necessarily what is good for everybody? Is there such thing as a common good?
So I'm going to say, I'm not going to take the question on common good exactly, but I am going to say that I think the book argues that what we need is to move from living in competition to living in common. And that requires at both a kind of psychological or affective level, like we have to find ways to spark a desire for being with other people and not being these self-enclosed individuals. And that means being with people that might be threatening or different, who might not add value seemingly, right? A kind of radical equality. But I think the other part of common is we have to build a kind of political and economic system that is based on and premised on the egalitarian production and sharing of wealth, right? Neoliberalism can look very progressive when it speaks about diversity and meritocracy, but ultimately, you know, if we want a common society, we need to be thinking about equal outcomes and that we all have a part to play and the right to, you know, participate in redefining and building the world and appropriating the wealth that we can all produce together equally. So.
Julie, I really appreciate you being on our show. Everybody should check out your book, Neoliberalism, and this whole discussion series that's happening over at Rutledge. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care.
You've been listening to a This Is Hell interview. For more Interview Hell and to support the show, visit thisishell.com.